Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. The novelist Jonathan Franzen gave himself a daunting assignment at the approach of his 60s. It was to start and finish an epic trilogy of novels under the joke title, A Key to All Mythologies, about Americans in crisis, starting with the Church family of Hildebrandts in suburban Chicago in 1971, Vietnam time. Book one, titled Crossroads, opens with the adulterous misery of Russ Hildebrandt, a pastor fast losing the respect of his congregation and his family. But sorrows and secrets of all sorts lurk in the lives of these Hildebrandts. Mental illness, drug addiction, moral contention, and chaos rising around military service in an immoral war. All of it testing Franzen's psychological acuity and his taste for theology and family relations. He told me at the outset of our conversation that Crossroads is the first of his novels that his late mother would have liked. She was his standard of compassion.
Well, she didn't like my first two novels. She wished I would just quit being a novelist. And I don't think she would have liked the next three, particularly. There was a level of psychological violence and kind of cruelty to some extent in order to get humor out of the book. So this book, which has let go of the cruelty, let go of the wish to be funny at all costs, and really tries to take each of the five characters on his or her own terms, I think to the extent that she was a reader at all, this might have been a book she would enjoy.
What jumps out at me in Crossroads is the force of religious thinking in this Hildebrandt family in a white suburb of Chicago, 1971. It's a church family, four preacher's kids, who can all talk theology, which is a shock until I listened back to Top 40 music on Chicago's famous WLS. It was the sound of pop culture in the times and of our presidential politics, too.
105 at WLS and the Gary Gear Show, making Wednesday better.
I remember that Christmas of 1971 very, very well. I was on a break from covering George McGovern running for the Democratic nomination for president. George McGovern had a seminary education. He was full of social gospel Christianity, part of his politics too. And then Jimmy Carter, 4 years later, more outspokenly a Christian and a religious man. Some part of that conversation has dropped out of American life, or been subdued, or corrupted, or forgotten. What did it mean to you? And where did it go? What are we missing? It sounds familiar.
Oh, yeah. That was possibly the second song I can remember ever loving and listening for hours, waiting for it to maybe play again, because, of course, recordings were not really an option for a 10-year-old. Yeah, it was a different time, and I was part of that time. There was nothing frightening about the church to me. The book is set in the years immediately preceding Roe v. Wade, which marked a real turning point, I think, for American religion. It energized the Christian right in a way they had not been energized before. And within 20 years, Christian had become almost a dirty word in progressive circles. It had become so exclusively associated with that homophobia and that hollow moralism and really, frankly, anti-Christian mindset of the evangelical right.
And yet it fascinates you. I mean, does it still mark you in a way, that 71 thinking?
I started the decade when I was 11 and I finished it when I was 21. Those are pretty important years. And I spent six of those 10 years involved in a Christian youth group, although it wasn't a very religious group. It was more of a social and political thing. Nevertheless, I spent a whole lot of time in a church and, as I say, never learned to be frightened of it. It was a home.
One of your characters says it was more Rod McEwen than Jesus, but it was still a language and an outlook, and it's important, and I remember it well. In general, this is a book about families, one in particular, family disappointment between husband and wife, between parents and kids, love, desire, depression, recovery. The whole idea of manhood is up for grabs in the drama of gender, I think. It's about class lines. Before the word privilege took over, white people fumbling across the gaps with black Southside Chicago, with Navajos in Arizona, with laborers in Peru. It's about generations. I keep thinking, this is volume one, you say, 600 pages in what's going to be a trilogy. The kids in this story of the early 70s will be in their 70s when you finish with them. What's the path forward here? Where are we going?
Where are we going? Well, if I knew that, it wouldn't be very fun to write it, would it? But Crossroads wasn't supposed to be a book. It was supposed to be the first section of a book that spanned 50 years. And in becoming a book, it really became its own thing. And it became its own thing because I found my way to all of my youthful memories, which I'd never used in my fiction. The 70s are curiously absent from my other novels. And those were the years when, you know, I had my first kiss. I had my first snowstorm. These things that become the primal memories, and I'd never drawn on them. And when I found that they were there, underutilized, I wanted to spend time with them. So the book became that assemblage of pages that I could write, enjoyed writing about those five characters in that world. There will be recurrent characters, but I don't see it as a seamless progression forward. They're big jumps.
We surely got to find out what happens to young Perry.
Yes, poor Perry, who has mental illness. That kind of thing, as we know, is intractable. So if I were a betting man, I'd say I bet Perry is still struggling with those exact same issues 25 years later.
Speak in general about these Hildebrandts, Russ and his wife Marion, three kids that we're hearing from this time, Clem, Becky, and Perry. A model family in certain external ways, if you didn't get to know them well, but they're tearing themselves apart and they're blowing themselves up in this novel. What is bugging this family?
They are dealing with, well, let's see, they're dealing with the fact that it's 1971 and a lot was happening in 1971. Men were leaving their wives in unprecedented numbers. Women were beginning to discover their own potential, their own power. Kids were rebelling against parents, although in this case, it's a different valence than certainly my household, where my parents were culturally quite conservative, and it was the sons who were doing the traditional things of growing their hair long and doing drugs and things like that. In this case, the parents themselves are old liberals. They are old progressives, deeply involved in the civil rights movement the previous decade, actively leading protests against the Vietnam War. And the children, in many ways, are already in the way that many people would get 20 years later, a little impatient with that brand of liberalism on their parents' part.
But no, Russ is a liberal in the flesh. He had been a conscientious objector in World War II, of all things, and he's also totally preoccupied with God and his relationship to God. He's a serious, serious man, by my count. But let me just say, the character that I still want to hug is Marion, his wife. She has a troubled history from her father, who committed suicide. She has a kind of secret past that she hasn't told her husband even. Yet in the crisis of the family, she is still a mediator, still a peacemaker. Imperfect, she's the enemy of at least one of her children, but she prays still. And I found that fascinating, as well as eloquent. And when her genius teenager, Perry, crashes in a horrific drug scene, she says this: "Dear God, I accept your will, and you've given me no more than what I deserve, but please let it be your will that Perry gets better the same way you once let me get better. Please also let it be your will that I don't go crazy again." I love the prayers in this book.
Prayers, I think, are akin to dreams in the pages of a novel. You definitely want to use them sparingly. But yes, Marion, I think, she came to God from a completely different direction. Russ grew up in a Mennonite community, hence his conscientious objection in the Second World War. Marion grew up in a secular household in San Francisco. Her father was a non-observant Jew, her mother, by her own description, a Whiskapalian. And it was in the aftermath of her troubles as a young woman that she found her way to the Catholic Church. And the schema of the Catholic Church, wherein guilt is not just a feeling, but a real thing, a thing you have to come to terms with, and good is a real thing, God is a real thing, evil is a real thing, that made sense to an impressionable, rather brilliant young woman who had just been through an absolutely horrific set of experiences. And that leaves a mark. You can set it aside for long years. And frankly, Russ, for all his communication with God and the fact that he does pray, is able to just set the whole question aside for months at a time while he pursues things that God would not approve of.
Right. And it's fascinating that he relies on Marianne in a pinch to write his sermons.
On a weekly basis, he relies on her. So you find your way to family patterns, and the family pattern of the breadwinning but fundamentally weak an ordinary father who's married to a behind-the-scenes brilliant woman who does most of the lifting in terms of childcare and even does the intellectual lifting to the point of writing his sermons for him. That's a pattern we all know, right?
Mm.
And it has a certain political weight 50 years later. There were a whole lot of marriages like that. And indeed, it's straight from real life. I have a very, very good friend who found out when she was 14 that her mother had had a brief failed marriage that had never been spoken of.
Mm.
And even my friend's siblings didn't know about it. I think she was the first or the second of her siblings to find out. Again, that was the sort of thing that could happen in those days. You make a mistake in the 1940s, and then you move right into this kind of subdued, not suburban in this case, but a subdued domestic life where you just don't speak of those things. And the idea was, at a certain point, particularly when your children start making the same mistakes you made, they erupt. I would say fundamentally that's what's happening to this family, is that stuff that was never resolved in the parents' youth comes back to haunt them. Not in a kind of clumsy, haunting way, but stuff that wasn't dealt with now needs to be dealt with.
Coming up, what Jonathan Franzen feels today is a world on the brink of major shocks. This is Open Source. Jonathan Franzen, novelist of family strife and American sorrow, writes in his new book, Crossroads, about the quiz kid named Perry on the verge of a breakdown. Jonathan Franzen, I'd love to read a kernel of your book and your writing. In the scene where Perry, the teenager with 160 IQ, it is said, but he's dealing drugs to his junior high school classmates, and he comes to Crossroads, this Christian fellowship, and is discovered to be drunk. Although in some respects Perry had never experienced anything more horrible, he was also thrilled by the quantity and intensity of attention he was getting as a sophomore and a newcomer just for having drunk some gin. When he broke down in tears, weeping with shame, authentically, the group responded in a kind of ecstasy of supportiveness, advisors praising him for his courage, girls crawling over to hug him and stroke his hair. It was a crash course in the fundamental economy of Crossroads, public display of emotion, purchased overwhelming approval, to be affirmed and fondled by a roomful of peers, most of them older, many of them cute, was exceedingly pleasant. Perry wanted more of this drug.
I did write that. Thank you for reading it.
What's wrong with Perry?
What's wrong with Perry? Well, Perry is cynical. Like a lot of super bright kids, he thinks too much, and he can't just be what he is. He can't just experience an emotion. He thinks about it, and he thinks about its usefulness to him. He's also the third child, and the older two siblings have tons of parental approval. The oldest child, Clem, is committed to social justice like his father, highly principled, super admirable, hard worker. The daughter, Becky, is too obviously the father's darling. She's super popular at school. And then there's Perry. He has no choice but to be that kind of calculating rationalist, trying to get his little piece of the pie, however he can. And it's funny. I didn't want to just render a liberal Christian fellowship from that era in an uninflected way. If it's just people having an intense experience, well, that's boring. But to introduce the cynic, somebody who sees it as a game, and a game that he's in a position to win, that immediately launches it into the realm of humor.
But it's hard not to be reminded, obviously, and people have noted this, that Perry reminds us of your great friend, who we had the privilege of interviewing, David Foster Wallace, who was drawn as a teenager and ever after into crises of understanding who he was, but also drugs, and eventually, finally, taking his own life. We're warned in Perry, I think. Are we not?
Well, it's funny. I mean, someone asked me about this last week, and I realized I was simply not thinking of Dave at all. Dave had been a presence in some earlier novels because he had a strong personality, and he had killed himself, and I had a very complex suite of emotions about that, and it was necessary and appropriate to get into that in the previous novels. But in this one, I just wasn't thinking of Dave. So that's all I can tell you. I've moved on. I had some models in mind. I knew a lot of druggy kids, and I knew a lot of really bright druggy kids in high school. In fact, they were, for the most part, the same people. It was precisely the students for whom class was easy who could afford to come to school tripping and get away with it because they were so smart. That really is the model for Perry. I don't think Dave ever sold drugs to seventh graders.
Yeah. Jonathan Franzen, let me just say generally, a lot of these characters are undergoing very grim periods in their life. Adultery, drug dealing, cruelty, depression. You put your readers in crisis too, in a certain way. You're so good at feeling the fluid relationships among these people. I wonder how you do it, how you track this amazing turns in relationships, but also what you want us to learn from this. I mean, the children who are mad for their parents and then completely alienated, won't have dinner with them and with each other. What are we learning?
I'm not in the business of teaching, so you can learn whatever you want.
Okay, that's a deal.
In terms of weaving it all together, I'm at pains to emphasize how much a novel dictates its own terms. And once I had set myself somewhat arbitrarily the task of 400 pages of action taking place on one afternoon and evening, I set about figuring out in a quite mechanical way what is happening between each of the five respective characters. It's mostly two-handed scenes, seldom group scenes. And honestly, I had a formal idea, and the formal idea was you'd be following five individuals as their paths keep crossing and keep crossing and keep crossing in the course of one evening, which is the kind of thing that might happen on the first day of school vacation 2 days before Christmas. They're all home, and they have things to do. There's a big concert at the church. There's a delivery of toys and canned goods to the south side of Chicago. There are these seasonal events that provided an opportunity to bring them all together. There's a lot of deductive story planning, and it all flows from having started by taking 2 years to figure out what the characters wanted. It sounds really kind of abstract, but it doesn't feel abstract to me. To be able to write down what each of the five characters wants, and then to give myself the rather constricting task of having it all unfold in one day, that's enough. Like, then the fun begins.
Do you make maps of these things? Is it like a chess puzzle, so to speak?
I did at one point have to make a chart of each of the five characters' physical whereabouts in the space of that evening, because I'm guessing many people wouldn't notice, but I knew there would be readers who would say, wait a minute, you said that was 9:30 and he was in the church at 9:30, but he's not in the church at 10:15, but he is in the church at 10:30. It's like, so I had to actually chart it out. Yeah.
Flesh out the Middlemarch connection. You started it in the sense you've referred to this trio of novels as a key to all mythologies, which comes out of George Eliot's great masterpiece. Some people say the greatest novel ever written, Middlemarch. I would have said Trollope was your model from that period of Victorian literature, not just a church connection, but the gentleness, the comprehensiveness, the fascination with relationships. But stick with Middlemarch for a moment. What are we looking for in that correspondence?
A Key to All Mythologies is simply a joke title. I needed to put a title on the proposal for the single volume this was supposed to be. I am interested in people's irrational belief systems. And the reason I've become more interested in it is because those irrational belief systems are ever more visible and aggressive as the world begins to fall apart, where we are right now, whether in the belief that Trump won the election by a landslide in 2020, whether in the belief that vaccines do more harm than good. These are irrational belief systems, and they are really, really becoming a problem. And mythology became kind of a catch-all term for that. So there I had the word mythology, and then there's poor Casaubon and his unfinishable book. And he is, to my mind, the most vivid character in Middlemarch. He is also probably the most poignant. And Eliot, one of her finest achievements, I think, as a novelist, was giving him his due, recognizing what a poignant figure he was, conveying to us how completely baffled he was by this marriage he'd gotten himself into, and how completely insufficient he was as a husband, and he knew it. I mean, that's novel writing at a high level. The joke was partly he never finished it. Everyone thinks they have a key to all mythologies, and good luck executing it. And in that sense, I'm tempting fate. I'm tempting the bus to hit me tomorrow so that I too, like Casaubon, don't finish my key to all mythologies.
Do we want to speak of the scope of Middlemarch, the Wagnerian giant performance of that novel?
We could. She's not the 19th century author I look to particularly. Undeniably a brilliant writer. Maybe not the best storyteller. Middlemarch is strong in almost everything, but it's not particularly strong in surprise. And it's actually not very strong in making you cry. And that's a long novel where you don't cry. She was brilliant, not taking anything away from that. But I'm looking for the novels that actually make you cry. I'm not a moralist. I have a certain reservation about novels that have a moral purpose, and I think Eliot always did have a strong sense of moral purpose with her work. I prefer a psychology that is more irrational, so I'm more inclined to look to, within England, someone like Charlotte Bronte, who seems to connect better with the demonic and the unaccountable. And then, you know, across the channel and over 1,500 miles east, there's Dostoevsky, who is
my man,
who was active at the same time. But no, I have the utmost respect for George Eliot, and yet she's not a touchstone for me. In Middlemarch, A Key to All Mythologies is itself a joke. It's one of the funnier jokes in the book. So to the extent that she's a comic writer, and she very much is, I love her.
Jonathan, you speak of the world beginning to fall apart, which opens a big gate. I would have said there's something radically wrong, entirely inadequate about American discourse at this point. We are up to our necks, we know, in killer breakdowns, in the climate, in public health, in the public mood, in social distance by class and race, around American competence. And there's virtually no way to connect on dealing with it. I mean, we are awash in BS, to be polite about it. The boldest truth teller about ourselves is in exile in Moscow, Edward Snowden, and he's not alone, sort of outside the realm of what can be spoken. I want you to speak about it and where the novelist sort of sets out to say something.
Still not hearing the question, Chris.
It's funny. I've been reading a lot of you and Thomas Mann the last few weeks, and Colm Tobin's wonderful novel about the life of Thomas Mann. Thomas Mann had felt and written in World War I, he spoke of a need for a European catastrophe. Deep in our hearts, he said, we feel that the world could no longer go on as it had. You've written about the climate fight, and not everybody liked it, but you said it's over, and we lost. And I'm hearing echoes of that kind of despair. Can you imagine feeling about your country, our country, that something is awry in the heart of it, something that's got to be cured, or else, maybe from outside, whatever that means?
You know, I'm not prescriptive, and I also am not much of a prophet of the future. I see a world that is on the brink of major shocks. And I think despite the putative denial of the climate crisis by nearly half of this country, I think everyone's aware that what the world is doing, what people are doing to the world, is not sustainable. There are demographic pressures that arise from that. People have underestimated just how important the matter of open borders and immigration is to people on the right, because although they may say climate change is a hoax, they recognize there are hundreds of millions of people who are going to be fleeing climate catastrophes and are at our doors, and we need to be strong. That's a cruel position. It's not one I'm advocating, but I think it's there. And I think more generally, between the coming climate catastrophe and the disorientations of technology run amok, particularly with artificial intelligence, but also the potential for robotics to put large parts of the country completely out of work, I think there's just a sense of we're out of control. From that comes a reflex to retreat into tribal identity. That tribal identity might be ethnic, but it can also be political, it can be cultural, it can be social. And you take that desperate fragmentation and you hypercharge it with the kind of discourse, or what passes for discourse, you find on social media, and you quickly get a very, very toxic environment.
I agree. And you have interesting new voices, but they're not getting through to the mass of us, it seems to me.
Well, who is the mass of us? That's the question. I am at pains to remind people that most of the country doesn't follow anything on Twitter. People who have Twitter feeds are, you know, they're a distinct minority of the country.
Yeah, a mischievous minority.
A mischievous and a very loud minority. Right. There may very well be a silent American majority that wishes for a lowering of the temperature, that wishes for a search for common ground. But by definition, they're a silent majority. You get a culture that is increasingly handed over to the hotheads and the self-promoters and the self-interested and the people who know how to work that system. I think that's where we are. I don't know that American culture, except in point of the legacy of slavery, is more diseased than any other country. When you look carefully at almost any place, even Denmark, even Norway, they're messed up countries. The ones that don't seem messed up are the ones that don't matter.
Well, I wonder, a couple points. Tony Judt, whom I greatly admired in his final book, said that we're in a state, this was 10 years ago maybe, in which the vast majority of people are not part of any public conversation, and they miss it, and they know it. This is compared to, say, I don't know, 70s or 60s of much more sort of popular conversation about real people, real politics, and real problems. But here's a small instance, but it's interesting. Do we have a public celebrated novel yet in which main characters voted for Trump? It seems that almost half of American voters are absent from American fiction.
Well, it takes a while to write a novel, and Trump was only elected 5 years ago. So, and I would go further. I would say I'm sure there are novels about Trump voters in the pipeline. I was writing about people who I'm sure were or would have been Trump voters in Freedom. That cultural divide, which manifested as a political divide, was already discernible easily 13 years ago, and indeed far longer, there were the angry white people who were kind of left behind and who drove pickup trucks and really, really resented the liberals for reasons the liberals were not in a position to comprehend. That has been building for a long time. And yes, it has been carefully cultivated and nurtured by outlets like Fox News and by the Republican Party. But Trump didn't appear out of nowhere, and the resentments that he fed on didn't appear out of nowhere.
But which issues are you thinking about? The who serves in the military in awful wars like Iraq and Afghanistan? Are you thinking about abortion or prayer in the schools or what? Immigration, maybe?
Well, immigration is certainly a powerful motivator. That was one of the two big issues that Trump ran on. Abortion motivates a certain segment of the population. My sense is that it is primarily rural. You can look at the maps. The division in this country isn't between red states and blue states. It's between the educated urbanites and the less educated, less privileged country people, small town people. This is a known political fact. I'm not making this up. And there is a sense, I think, on the part of that white minority that is substantially rural, that everyone else is getting ahead. And not only that, but everyone else is smug about the fact that they're getting ahead. And they think the people in the country are stupid. And man, is that a motivator. If you have the sense that other people think you are stupid, that is going to piss you off.
Coming up, Becky Hildebrandt, High on Pot. This is Open Source. I asked Jonathan Franzen to pick a passage to read arbitrarily, authorially, that might capture his Hildebrandts in a few sentences.
I mean, single paragraph. Wow, this is like, What do you want on your headstone?
He chose this glimpse of Becky losing control.
So here's Becky Hildebrandt, who has just smoked pot for the first time, trying to get away from people because she's become utterly paranoid. To her right lurked a hall full of eyes, so she ran up the stairs to the church attic. For a while in the dark, after the door had fallen shut behind her, she groped along a wall for a light switch, but then she forgot about doing this, only to remember and be struck by having forgotten. It's because I'm horribly stoned. She groped forward sideways, whimpering, an arm stretched out ahead of her. She collided with something sharp and metallic, a music stand, but nothing crashed. In the distance was a glimmer of bluish light. She tried to navigate by it, but lost sight of it and questioned its reality. The next thing she encountered was cool and angleless, extensive, hollow-sounding. It ended in a curving tapered tube, apparently a hollow-horned cow. It proved to be quite an impediment to her progress. An incalculably huge amount of time had passed since she entered the attic, and she had the sudden clear insight that time couldn't be measured without light. This seemed to her a crucial realization. She made a mental note to remember it, although she'd already lost her grip on what it meant. If she could just remember the words, "Time can't be measured without light," she might recapture their meaning later.
A recurring anxiety about control runs through this novel, Crossroads, raising questions. There's this tension between the church leaders. Russ Hildebrandt is an old-school strong guy who wants to be seen as such. And he's just sick about being upstaged in the Crossroads gathering by a sort of long-haired, groovy youth minister with a hip style. How is this working out with American manhood?
There's a little bit of my father in Russ Hildebrandt. My father came from a very, very small, remote town in northern Minnesota. He was the country boy, even at the county high school. He was the hick from the little town, and he carried that chip on his shoulder all his life. And then, for reasons that were never entirely clear for me, he didn't serve in the Second World War, and he carried that burden throughout his adult life. All the men he knew were veterans. That was the generation. And It was a principled stance on my father's part. He was deeply pacifist. He came from a Swedish pacifist family. Mm. But not having served, I think, created this sort of shadow on his manhood. For Russ, the combination of that acute innocence of being not only a country boy, a Mennonite country boy, coupled with his not checking the standard boxes of American manhood, apart from being very good with tools, mm-hmm. and being physically strong, which he is, it leaves him open to desperate insecurity on all fronts, and particularly when somebody a generation younger comes along and relates better to the young people than he can. Furthermore, I think there's, for Russ, the feeling that, hey, people look down on the 50s, but I was in Greenwich Village in the 50s, and people were every bit as progressive and interesting and alive as these supposedly amazing late 60s people are. And it just seems unfair to him. Like, I used to be cool, now I'm not cool. That's the formulation of somebody who has never ceased to be an adolescent. So you could argue that, in fact, that this is a book about five main characters, and four of them are adolescents, including the 47-year-old father.
Change the subject. We're still not quite sure where we are in respect to COVID. How has the pandemic and the American response, especially to a world crisis, how has it changed the way you think about the United States and us Americans?
I don't think it has fundamentally changed the way I think about America. I don't know what I think about America, frankly. I think America's problem is, and this is a Stanley Cavell idea, America thinks of itself as the good guy and wants to be loved and doesn't understand why the world doesn't love it. And there are reasons why the world doesn't love it. It was one of the great slaveholding societies of all time. And then it was the greatest imperial power in world history. And its record as an imperialist, not very pretty.
Right.
And yet we continue to think of ourselves as the good guys. Even I, if I'm not careful, find myself thinking, you know what, we're fundamentally a pretty good country. And part of my job as a novelist is to examine everyone who thinks they're pretty good and to allow for the possibility that they're not at all good, which, by the way, is a kind of religious concept. It's close to what Marian might say from her own Catholic experience. But I think it's just getting harder and harder to sustain the notion that we are somehow exceptional. Everyone gets the disease. We did a great job of coming up with vaccine in great quantities. That was actually a plus, and we do have to give the Trump administration some modicum of credit for that effort. But we're also one of the worst, we're undoubtedly the worst country in the world in terms of vaccination rates relative to availability of vaccines, which is crazy and irresponsible and all comes from this childish idea of freedom. It's built on the blood and bodies of others. American wealth is partly an accident of a continent ripe for the taking, but man, there's a whole lot of guilt we carry around and ought to be aware of. And that is an easier idea for someone who has a nice income and is living in the city and has two college degrees to entertain than it is for somebody who's working at a Walmart in a tough town in the middle of Indiana. To get through your day when life is hard and you feel like you've been left behind, you really need mythologies of being the good guy.
You wonder why we don't want to discharge that guilt, though, with reparations of some sort for the burden of slavery.
I would love to. I mean, if it were that easy, if it were a matter of everybody, according to his or her own means, contributing to a massive reparations fund, the administration of which would be tricky, to put it mildly. But nonetheless, if it were that easy, people who could afford to, I think, would be all for it. Like, there, we paid our reparations. Now we don't have to deal with the legacy anymore.
Yeah, thank you.
But even leaving aside the difficulty of administering that, would that really do it? Maybe not, because there are some things that money can't cure. Only time and concerted effort can cure.
Compare and contrast, John Franzen, your own work and that of the so-called auto-fictionists, getting to be popular and very, very numerous among the millennial writers. And it's not just Knausgård, it's all kinds of writers. here and elsewhere. What does the future look like for feeding the liberal imagination, so we say?
Perhaps you're picking up on the notion that liberalism arose with the novel arose with liberalism, and that the that the enterprise of both was to imagine what it's like to be someone you aren't.
Yeah, lots and lots of them, interesting people, yeah. As opposed to this kind of solipsistic conversation with myself at an extreme.
Well, if it's artfully enough done, it can be very entertaining and good. But so, first of all, I think third-person narrative involving perspectives that are not identical to the author's is alive and well. There are plenty of those stories out there. There are plenty of those novels out there. And there will continue to be, partly because they're easier to do, which is to say it's easier to create a compelling entertainment when you're allowed to write from other perspectives and when you are not handcuffed by the word I at every turn. All kinds of signification become possible with third person that simply aren't with first person, because third person is so clearly superior. If only at the genre novel level, that mode is going to persist as long as people are publishing and reading novels. That's really all I have to say. I think it's alive and well.
John Franzi, you're famously tough on Twitter and social media, Facebook, all of it. I wonder what elements of popular culture, besides them, make you despair, but which ones give you some hope?
I don't know if social media are actually constitutive of culture. They are media rather than content per se. What gives me pleasure? I take a guilty pleasure in sports, and it's particularly guilty when it comes to American football, because I know all the things that are wrong with football, and yet you watch a game like the Chiefs against the Ravens, and that is a high, high form of entertainment. Television in general has gotten so much better. It's astonishing to me. And there again, even if autofiction continues to make inroads in published novels, we have these incredible, multi-perspective, socially engaged telenovels in the form of cable dramas, which are proliferating and now streaming everywhere. It's really a golden age of television and a lot of smart people doing interesting things. So it's not like talent and creativity have disappeared. To some extent, they've migrated to a different medium, which I'm happy to claim is this subgenre of the novel. I before we talked, I thought I should get some coffee, and I went online and checked the location of the nearest Starbucks. I'm doing this from a hotel room in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I found one that appeared to be 8 minutes away. And I got there, I got about 6 minutes out, and I realized there's no way I'm going to get there, get my coffee, and get back before this interview starts. But this is perhaps another guilty confession. I think Starbucks is a really good development. You think about where
Which
we were.
Of it? I'm a Pete's guy.
Or a Pete's or whatever. But just think about trying to get an actually good coffee 30 years ago. Just not possible.
Almost impossible, yeah.
Almost impossible. So when people tell me American civilization is going down the tubes, I'm thinking, but look at the organic produce at the grocery store. And this is and it's locally grown, and it's so much better. And look at the coffee we get now. And pasta is not just something that comes in a Ronzoni box. You know, it's like, that is, of course, the privileged urban liberal speaking. But yeah, so it's some hits, some misses. I would say in general, there are two cultures in this country, and I am not part of the other one. But in my culture, I'm at pains to say that the questioning of old attitudes, old systems regarding race and other forms of identity in this country, I think that's on the whole, despite occasional excesses here and there, a very positive thing.
Yep.
And I have a long history with Germany through the accident of my having been a German major. And you can say what you want about the Germans, but they really, really took seriously in the decades after 1945, the task of coming to terms with what the Nazis had done. It's an incomplete project, and of course there's a growing backlash to that project from what would be the Trumpist parts of Germany. Nevertheless, there are models for countries that have engaged in a sustained decades-long attempt to come to terms with terrible things that they have done as a country. And I think there's some chance that we are seeing the beginning of a reckoning like that, that could ultimately, again, despite excesses at every turn, could have a very positive outcome.
Jonathan, I associate you with the revelation that what really distinguishes our culture, our people, our lives, is that we're massively entertained all the time. And you're one of the great entertainers who's wary of the trap, too. How do you deal with that?
I have a very broad understanding of the word entertainment. I, as a reader, can be entertained by any halfway well-written spy novel or police procedural, but there are other kinds of pleasure, and one of the chief ones is a sense of recognition. When someone notices something that I have noticed but never really allowed to consciousness, it makes me feel less alone. It feels like I'm not the only one who's felt that. I'm not the only one who has noticed that. Sometimes you have to take a risk of being disagreeable, because much of what is most interesting, most relatable, is also what is rather shameful. And the task of advanced fiction writing, I think, is to go to places that are not necessarily comfortable, but to do it in a way that nonetheless, at some level, feels entertaining, because you're in good hands. You trust the writer to have anticipated your discomfort and taken it into account and rendered something to minimize discomfort and maximize a sense of recognition. That's a stab.
That's good.
Okay.
Can you see yourself on the map of your own progress as a writer, as a novelist, since your St. Louis beginning, 27th City?
I labored at the beginning under the impression that novels could change the world. I looked to Catch-22 above all, which seemed to me to have participated in the public conversation and perhaps hastened the resistance to the Vietnam War. And I had an acute sense of social responsibility, and writing novels seemed almost uniquely irresponsible as a way to contribute to society. So I had this idea, no, you've got to... But the novel can change things. If you help make people see the injustice in the world and the corruption in the world will become a better place. And my life and also my novels got a lot better when I let go of that idea and came around to a notion of a community of readers and writers, and that the service was not to society with a capital S, but service to that community. Even then, it's been a long road to letting go of an impulse to comment on contemporary reality, to engage with it at a theoretical and issue level, and to come to what I think I'm meant to be, which is a novelist of character and psychology. Crossroads really feels like the first book where I've been fully the writer I am meant to be.
That's a reward in itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. And it could just be an illusion of advancing age and fading powers. It's related to the what I said about this being a book my mother might actually have liked. I never cared about my mother's approval, and certainly for the last 22 years, she hasn't been here, so her approval matters even less than it ever did. So it's not about approval, but it's about a sense of coming full circle and being the child of my parents, my honest father, and my keen-eyed mother, and my kind mother, and my father who believed in courtesy and with love and kindness as the highest values. And I'm trying to get there.
Your book is astonishing, Jonathan Franzen, and to me it's a kind of great lift to think that this kind of work is being done in our midst about our country and our world. Cannot thank you enough for the book and for this conversation.
Chris, it was a real pleasure talking to you. Thanks for having me on.
Jonathan Franzen's big novels in this young century are The Corrections, Freedom, Purity, and now Crossroads. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. Mary McGrath is the minister to youth in our little Crossroads. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a nonprofit collective of some of the best podcasts out there. This week, check out Rumble Strip, where host Erica Heilman explores perspectives on the subtle art of criminal defense. Find it at rumblestripvermont.com and check out the whole Hub and Spoke lineup at hubspokeaudio.org.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.